2518-DOLR v. Jeffrey. Is it Reitz or Reitz?
Reitz.
Thank you, Mr. Reitz. We'll hear first from Mr. Reitz, and then from Mr. Herman, and Mr. Reitz, you'll get 5 minutes in rebuttal. Would you proceed, please?
Justices of the Supreme Court, I'm Jeffrey Reitz. I'm representing myself in this matter relative to the Office of Lawyer Regulation. I was originally admitted to practice law in 1981 upon graduation in Wisconsin. I've not had any prior disciplinary proceedings since the time that I have been licensed to practice. This proceeding hasn't exactly been pleasant. I guess it's not a good thing that it would be. Mr. Herman's been very professional and a gentleman working with throughout this process. There are 13 counts in the complaint, which is brought by Office of Lawyer Regulation in this matter. I've filed an appeal as to 4 of those counts. One of those counts relative to Nari Crosby. In review for oral argument this morning, I found the brief of Mr. Herman to be fairly persuasive, and I'm not really going to be talking about that particular issue. That particular issue is the drafting of the document titled a release, releasing the liability of another attorney, my partner Michael Mandelman. In reviewing the law, I think that even though it wasn't my intention to prepare a release, even though Mr. Mandelman didn't ask for one, the fact that a benefit was conferred by conduct that I think probably was not appropriate is a good reason for sanction, and so I'm not really going to discuss that. I'm willing to concede that I should be disciplined for that. Basically, on these matters,
there are three
at this time, Your Honor.
I mean, that is count 3 that you're talking about?
I believe that that is part.
Yes.
Is it 3, not 2? I'm not sure. Do you know for sure if it's count 3 you're talking about rather than 2? That's okay. We can look if you don't know.
I believe it is 3,
okay.
Your Honor.
What about count 2? With that relates to Crosby, too?
That does relate to Crosby also, Your Honor.
All right. Is that one still in challenge?
That one is, and okay. I can address that one at this point, I guess. Basically, the facts concerning that situation are pretty much laid out in the briefs of the parties and in the various exhibits. I prepared a document entitled release of Michael Mandelman. Essentially, Mr. Mandelman had requested that a document be prepared indicating that Ms. Crosby had been happy with the work that he performed for her up to that point, and that if he did not get that, he did not want to take a deposition scheduled of the opposing party in that matter. I did prepare the document, which was an exhibit. It was entitled release. It did contain release language of Attorney Michael Mandelman. The count that I am challenging essentially is relating to preparation of a document releasing the lawyer, myself, from liability. And that release doesn't really do it. I'm not happy, and I indicated in my brief I'm not happy with the fact that I even did this document in the first place, and I'm willing to accept the responsibility and take the hit for that. But I think that it's basically the document itself is releasing another attorney, and so I think that that would be the appropriate violation of the rules with respect to that, that it's not really a violation as far as obtaining a release of myself. I know that in the brief of the Office of Lawyer Regulation, they indicated that there was some sort of nebulous or vicarious benefit to myself if a partner was released. I think that that's kind of a stretch. I think that the rule is fairly clear on that. Based on my actions, I think that there was a violation, but I don't think that it was this particular violation. And I think just the language of the document itself is clear in that respect.
What violation do you believe it was?
I would believe it was a violation in assisting another attorney to violate the rules.
That's count 3, which you're conceding.
That is
correct.
Do
you think that there should only be one count relating to Crosby, not 2 counts?
We're relating to that release with Crosby. That is correct, Your Honor.
All right.
What about the fact that you're both partners in the same law firm?
The release was not of the law firm. It was basically of an individual attorney. And It's questionable even if the language would have been an enforceable release. I'm not sure that there, some of the appropriate language that might have been there was there. But the fact is it says release. An unsophisticated person might have thought it was a release, and it was a stupid move. And
let me ask you this. There were numerous counts. Let's see, 13. You're conceding 10, in effect, as of today.
That is correct, Your Honor.
You're disputing 3. The real dispute, if I understand it, is the reason you're disputing these 3 or 4 would be that I would expect, that you would expect, that the sanction would be reduced. That is, the recommendation here is 6 months, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So if you can knock out 3 counts, I'm assuming you have two choices. One, even if all 13 or 14 counts are proved, 6 months is too long. That's one argument. Two, when you knock out 3 counts, the remaining 10 don't justify 6 months, right?
That would be correct, Your Honor.
Which is your argument?
I don't. Actually, both, Your Honor. I don't think that with if all counts are proven, I still think that the recommendation of the sanction is too much.
Okay.
But I do feel that at least on the 3 that I'm addressing at this point in time, that I don't think that the findings supported the conclusions of law and the finding of a sanction in those matters.
All right.
And I'm assuming, since I've never been here before in these types of cases, that that can have an effect relative to what the court would feel appropriate.
Sure, it does. The number and the seriousness of each offense and the cumulative seriousness affects the sanction. So I'm assuming that's why you're making this argument. And so the question is, you think it's excessive, but you do agree that a shorter sanction is appropriate. And you're suggesting 2 to 4 months. Is that right?
That is correct.
I just want to get this in a perspective.
Yes, that is correct.
All right. So unless people have some question or you want to say something further about count 2, we should go to the next counts.
The next count, and again, I apologize, Your Honor, I don't have the exact count in front of me, is relative to Lindsay Krause with respect to making fraudulent or misrepresentations or untrue statements to Ms. Krause. Essentially, I had prepared a summons and complaint at the request of my partner, forwarded a copy to Ms. Krause for review, and subsequent to that had several conversations with her. The facts and the testimony and the findings are fairly clear that Ms. Krause was under the impression immediately following that the summons and complaint was being filed in court. My testimony essentially was that I had not advised her of that, although, again, it is clear that she apparently had that opinion. This particular count in this ethical rule violation, which is alleged, is indicating there's something more, that I'm affirmative. It seems to me that making an affirmative representation or trying to defraud her in some respect or mislead her, and I don't think that the findings of fact are supported by the evidence which was justly submitted at the hearing, and accordingly, I don't believe that particular conclusion was warranted. Ms. Krause, first of all, as I recall, this was approximately in March of that year in which the summons and complaint was prepared and a copy was forwarded to her. There was testimony which is contained in a copy of my brief from Ms. Krause as far as a meeting on July 9th. She specifically said, I talked to him in person. I went to his office on July 9th and reiterated that I wanted to sue American Country because the $17,000 settlement was not adequate for me. It seems to me that that's pretty clear and unequivocal that at least as of July 9th, she's saying, I'm telling Wrights I want to sue them. So at that point in time, it seems uncontroverted that she was aware at least that a lawsuit was not pending at that time. near the end of Ms. Causey's testimony before the referee, she had also indicated that on cross-examination, and again, the exact language is contained in the exhibits and in my brief, that, and I can question, says, I suspect now that when you were trying to do was discuss a possible mediation, but you used terms that indicated to me that you were going to court. She also indicated that you were going in a direction I didn't know you were going in. I was talking apples and you were talking about oranges. This is just my impression when I look back and review my notes.
Can I just ask my question? You actually sent, just so I'm on the right one now, you actually sent to Ms. Krause a copy of the summons and complaint for her lawsuit, right?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And that was signed. In other words, it wasn't just two pieces of paper. It was signed, and the impression, as I gather, that this was what was at least appeared to her to be filed in the lawsuit, the summons and the complaint. Have I misstated anything?
Your Honor, I think that there was other testimony from Ms. Krause that she wasn't really sure if it had been filed or not, but she was under the impression that it was going to be.
Yeah. I'm just reading from the red brief on page 12 where the document stated that please find enclosed a copy of the summons and complaint for your lawsuit. That's what she received, right?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And that document enclosed with a letter was a summons that and complaint that you had signed.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Again, in this count on Krause, there are two counts. One, which you're not challenging, relates to diligence.
That's correct.
The other one that you are challenging is a misrepresentation count, which might appear more serious than a lack of diligence case.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Here's the problem I have, and I think judges have. The referee saw and heard the client and saw and heard you and made a judgment about credibility. And I don't mean to attack your credibility here. In fact, you're doing a very good job, and it's not easy to defend yourself. I'd rather defend a client than myself. But how do we get around the rule that credibility issues, you follow what the trial court or here the referee does? Now, you could argue that impression doesn't constitute misrepresentation. Or maybe you have another argument. But do you know, you see what I'm driving at?
Yes, I do, Your Honor.
Okay.
It seems to me that, first of all, the Office of Lawyer Regulation, and I hate to argue burden of proof, but the Office of Lawyer Regulation has the burden of proof.
Absolutely. They're unconvincing.
That is correct, Your Honor. If you were to pretty much completely ignore my testimony at the trial of this matter and only take what Ms. Causey had indicated, she did indicate on cross-examination that it's very possible that I was talking apples and she was oranges. I was talking mediation. She was talking going to court. If she's, you know, if she was the one that originally initiated, you know, by filing the complaint with respect to that, and I appreciate that, and there's no question that she had that impression initially. But in retrospect, if she's looking at it saying, you know, I'm not really sure. Maybe you weren't trying to mislead me. I think that if you're just looking at what she said and completely ignore myself because assuming just that I'm just incredible, that doesn't meet the clear and convincing standard that would be necessary for finding of the misrepresentation and fraud. And that's where I'm coming from in that respect, Your Honor.
Good. Okay. I mean, that does explain a technique for overcoming this credibility issue. And it's focused on her testimony that in retrospect she thinks that maybe there was a miscommunication, that when you said in your March 7th telephone conversation, as she recalls it, that you were going to send documentation regarding going to court, she assumed you meant going to court. And she, in retrospect, thinks you were talking about mediation. Is that summing it up correctly? And then
essentially, that's it, Your Honor. I had testified that we were talking about mediation subsequently. But even if you wanted to completely throw out what I had said after sending the summons and complaint to her, I think that her testimony is such that she says, you know, I'm not even sure at this point if you were really, you know, what you were saying.
But the thing that concerns me is even if it were mediation, why do you send a summons, a signed summons and complaint? And March 7th, you said you were going to be sending documentation as to, I guess, going to court. That's her testimony. Why is a why did you think the signed summons and complaint was documentation regarding mediation?
Yeah, and I'm going to try to recall exactly what the testimony was at the hearing because I don't want to get into anything that may not have been there. But my understanding was that my partner had requested that I would prepare a summons and complaint regarding this matter because Ms. Carls had wanted to go to court. I prepared it. I sent it to her. We subsequently had discussions relative to trying to resolve the matter by mediation because it would be more quick. That's essentially what I'm saying, Your Honor, is that, you know, we did send our summons and complaint, but there were subsequent conversations concerning trying to resolve it by mediation because it would be more quickly resolved, probably, maybe not, but the loss of time might not be too significant. And so that's essentially it, Your Honor.
If there are no further questions, and do you want to say anything further about it? That's count 7, according to me.
I have nothing additional, Your Honor.
Okay. Then we should go to Ashley. You do not contend. Now I've lost where it says which client.
Colpeck was count 12.
Count 12. Okay.
Your Honor, with respect to Clyde Colpeck, our office was representing him in claims for injuries sustained in a motorcycle accident. There's really not any dispute, as I understand it, as far as in the findings of fact on this matter. I think that the real question is whether or not the facts, as they're essentially agreed and as they were heard, reach the standard of a violation of the rules. And I, obviously that's for this court's determination. I'm not sure. Basically, my understanding is that in these types of matters, what we're looking at is the de minimis standard, which is obviously not what we're trying to obtain. We shoot for more than that, but on these types of matters, we're looking at the de minimis standard. Mr. Colpeck had testified at the trial, and I believe that there are findings that he had had some difficulty being able to speak with myself or my partner, Mr. Mandelman, at times. On occasion, he would receive phone calls from us at times. Normally, he was the one that would initiate phone calls to the law firm. Quite often, he would speak with the office staff concerning questions, and typically, the office staff would get back to him with answers to whatever questions that he'd had, either or that day or the following day. I guess the way that I'm looking at it, Your Honor, is if Mr. Colpeck is calling, he's speaking with somebody, and he's getting the answers that he's looking for, it seems to me that there's at least communication so that he's knowing what's going on, even though perhaps it's not as good as what it should have been. Obviously, in a perfect world, we would try to anticipate before our client's going to call, and in fact, attorneys do that. If there's something significant going to be happening or it appears that something needs to be prepared for, we will do that. We, you know, initiate contact with our client. In this case, Mr. Kolbeck's testimony is that did not happen very often, but that he did call regularly and that he did get answers. And my only issue is whether or not that is de minimis or if that's an ethical failing. I'm certainly not happy with the problems that arose over the couple of years after I changed my circumstances, and which are reflected in this complaint and these proceedings before you. I just want to make sure that there's a fair review, and any questions that I have, I'm bringing these to your attention, and it appears to me at least that minimum standard may have been met with respect to the communication and keeping him advised as far as what was actually going on.
Again, in 11, which you don't challenge here, you are conceding that you did not pursue the injury claim in a timely fashion. And what you're objecting to on 12 is whether you kept him reasonably informed. Do
That's
I have
correct,
that
Your
right?
Honor.
Okay. All right.
Again,
there's no question of facts. It's a question of law as to whether these facts constitute reasonably informed.
That's the only question, Judge, Your Honor.
Are there any questions about that? Justice Prosser?
Could I go back to count 3, the count relating to your preparing a release for Mr. Mandelman? Has Mr. Mandelman been accused of any violation of the rules of professional conduct?
It's my understanding that he has, yes. Basically, Your Honors, then I get...
Well, what I was going to ask you before you sit down is on what basis, and this is always very difficult, do you think 2-4 is more reasonable in fitting with the general pattern of sanctions that the court has imposed on other lawyers? Because
right.
In effect, if you average it out, you'd say, and this is not the way we do it, that it's 3-6, I mean, just 2-4, just for the sake of discussion.
I have, again, in preparing my brief and subsequent also, I had a chance to review other situations where this court has ruled.
Right. Are you familiar with the compendium that we have?
I am not, Your Honor.
Okay, go ahead. But you did review them.
Yes. And in my situation, basically, I've been practicing since 1981. I've had no previous problems up until this point. I guess I'm trying to look at this as far as what appears serious and what is less serious. Everything is serious, but there's got to be some sort of a scale on that. And we're not looking at a situation where I'm engaging in criminal conduct. I'm not stealing clients' money. I'm not representing more than one client at the same time to the detriment of another. A lot of these, not all of them, but many of these are basically things that it's office procedures and practices that needed to be shaped up. And those are types of things that can be remedied. And Mary Crosby clearly was just a major lapse in judgment. And I just don't, with respect to Ms. Crosby, with respect to misrepresentations and fraud and so forth, I guess, Your Honor, I know what happened. I didn't intend to deceive anybody. It's obvious that she had that impression, and you know, the court can certainly consider that as it will based on the standards that it has to review. But based on what I can see and based on the fact that I have not had any previous problems, I feel that somewhere in that 2-4 range is more appropriate than 6 months. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Reitz. Greg Herman, representing the Office of Lawyer Regulation.
Chief Justice, Justices of the Court, please the Court, I'm Greg Herman. I'm retained counsel for the Office of Lawyer Regulation in this matter. First, appreciate the concession to Mr. Reitz that on review of our brief, he concedes count number 2. It's rare enough that my briefs convince the court of anything, but even more rare that we convince opposing counsel. Nonetheless, while I appreciate the concession, there is a distinction between counts 2 and count 3. It's a fine line in extent, but I would like to call your attention to the footnote number 2 of the referee's report. It's copied in the blue brief in the appendix. And in OLR's complaint, we alleged that Mr. Reitz was an attorney at law practicing in Wisconsin. And the referee notes in a footnote that Mr. Leitz admits that paragraph, except that he claimed in his response that the correct name of the firm is Leitz & Mandelman, LLC. The purpose of pointing that out is not the name of the firm as much as it is the LLC nature of it, standing for Limited Liability Corporation. Remember that in an ethics matter, it's individual against an attorney, but the release which Mr. Leitz secured from Ms. Crosby was not an ethics release, which, of course, lawyers can't do under any circumstances whatsoever. It's a release from liability, which attorneys can only do under extremely limited circumstances, none of which were present in this case, the primary one being that the client must have independent legal representation. What happened in this case is Ms. Crosby was represented by the firm of Leitz & Mandelman, LLC, in a malpractice action against a previous attorney. After the case had had substantial problems, including Mr. Leitz being sanctioned for failure to comply with discovery and being fined $300 by the trial court, they scheduled a deposition of the defendant. Ms. Crosby comes to their office, and Mr. Leitz meets with her and says, you know, in our office, Mr. Mandelman handles the discovery. I do all the pre-work, but he does all the depositions and all the trial work. So he's going to handle the deposition, but he's not going to handle this deposition until you sign this release. And he presents a written release, and in my cross-examination of Mr. Leitz, I asked him, as he admitted, that he's a personal injury lawyer, his main area of activity, as Mr. Leitz admitted in his cross-examination, as a personal injury law, it's very common to secure releases. I mean, that's one of the things you do when you settle cases, is you want your client released from any further or future liability regarding that claim. So I find Mr. Leitz's claim that this really wasn't a release not to be very compelling, but in particular, he knew what he was doing when he met with her and was taking advantage of this woman who's there in a case which is having a substantial amount of problems, being told that Mr. Mandelman will handle the deposition, which is fine, except that Mr. Mandelman is not going to handle the deposition unless she signs this release. And OLR is claiming there are really two violations here. And they're related and they're close, but they are two separate ones. And the facts of this case make it meaningful. One of them is that by securing the release of Mr. Leitz's partner, because it's a release from a malpractice action, and a malpractice action, it would not be against the attorney individually, it's against the law firm. That's why lawyers set up LLCs. It's to insulate the attorney personally from liability. So by securing the release of Mr. Mandelman, Mr. Leitz was also securing his own release because any lawsuit, any malpractice suit that Ms. Crosby would bring would be against the LLC. In addition, interestingly, Mr. Leitz had the release against Mr. Mandelman personally as opposed to against himself, so he was also assisting another attorney in violating the rule. So while they're very much related in this case, they are separate violations and they do have separate elements to them. And so while I appreciate Mr. Leitz's admission that he did assist Mr. Mandelman in violating the rule in getting the release, Mr. Leitz was also securing a release of himself at that point and doing it in violation of 1.8H.
Now, Mr. Herman, how did the release of Mr. Mandelman, in effect, immunize Mr. Leitz?
It did not immunize him because it's an ineffective release because it violates Supreme Court rules. It was intended to insulate Mr. Leitz by releasing the law firm from liability from Ms. Crosby. It wasn't well done. It wasn't effective. And it wasn't particularly good operational law.
Let's just say, hypothetically, that the release was valid. How would anything in that release immunize Mr. Leitz?
The lawsuit that would be brought would have to be against the service corporation. and Mr. Reitz was a partner in the service corporation.
The release did not only Mandelman, but also the corporation.
The release only said Michael Mandelman, but by releasing an attorney from it, the way the release is worded, it was clearly intended to be a release from malpractice of the law firm, which Mr. Reitz was a part of. So I don't think he can isolate himself by saying, you know, I was helping Mr. Mandelman get a release, but I don't particularly care if she came after me and sued me. And this is particularly in a case where, please understand, Mr. Reitz has admitted lack of diligence, where he was sanctioned by the court, and where there were substantial problems in their handling of this case in many ways. Eventually, the case was dismissed because of the failure to name an expert witness. There were all sorts of problems they were having in this, and securing release was obviously very important for that firm. It was, quite frankly, not well done. It was, even if it was within the rules, and Ms. Crosby had separate counsel, this wasn't a particularly good way of doing it. But it's not a violation of the rules if you violate it intelligently. It's a violation of the rules if you violate it at all. And the fact that it was ineffective and not a particularly appropriate way of doing it in a number of different fashions doesn't insulate Mr. Reitz from the violation.
I thought I heard this morning Mr. Reitz indicate that Mr. Mandelman is the one who asked for the release.
That was Mr. Reitz's testimony that Mr. Mandelman asked him for the release. But as far as
the very fact that Mr. Mandelman allegedly asked him for the release, I think is one reason why he's conceding count three.
It may be. But that doesn't insulate him from a violation of count two. The rule says that an attorney cannot secure a release or request a client in 1.8H. If I can get the rule, please, Your Honor.
A lawyer shall not make an agreement prospectively limiting the lawyer's liability to a client.
Right.
I'm really having trouble arriving at the conclusion, not that there was some impropriety here, but that this release immunized this attorney when the release named a different attorney, didn't even name the law firm. I mean,
because they were partners in the law firm, Your Honor.
Well, but you said an LLC is a way of immunizing each partner against the other partner's malpractice, right?
To some extent, Your Honor, what an LLC does is immunize the attorney personally.
Okay. So the law firm rights was immunized personally against Mandelman's malpractice by the LLC. Is that right?
That's the purpose of an LLC.
Let's just go to the law. Is that right?
To an extent, yes. There are ways, as we know, of piercing the corporate veil. And in the lawsuit against an LLC, if Ms. Crosby had filed a malpractice action, she would probably name the LLC and each attorney individually.
And my understanding is that the release attempted to immunize the law firm.
It is, yes, we're intending that the intention of securing the release was to immunize the law firm and the attorneys.
Okay. And if the release intended to immunize the law firm, then rights would be immunized as part of the law firm.
Yes.
And therefore, I mean, I'm not saying I'm accepting all this, but I'm trying to understand your argument. Therefore, since he immunized the law firm and immunized himself, this release falls under that subsection.
Yes.
Okay. So the goal was to immunize him. You say it's badly done. It may not have been successful, but that's what happened.
Yes. If there was no partnership here, Mr. Mandelman was an attorney across the street who said, Mr. Reitz, can you help me out in this or whatever, then it would only be one count. It would be just assisting the other attorney.
Mr. Herman, let me ask this. I think it's the fact that it was, as you said, badly done that gives me a little pause. I mean, what you're trying to read in is an intent by the act of preparing the release. But if the release is not prepared to actually effectuate the goal and it was prepared poorly to even protect Mr. Mandelman, I'm not sure you can show that the wrongful intent, what it appears you may have, is just something that was poorly done. How do you read intent into that?
Well, the intent is not an element, Your Honor, and I'm trying
to... But that's what you've argued, and that's what I'm trying to follow.
I'm trying to say I believe that the intent was, and if this had been well done, obviously I think you typically in the releases you see release everybody in the world, including whoever cleaned the floors and washed the windows from liability. This wasn't that type, and as Mr. Reitz testified in the hearing, and I believe I'll use in his brief, this was done quickly, that Mr. Mandelman asked him to do it. He went, picked up a form, and immediately started drafting something. 1.8H states, an attorney shall not make an agreement prospectively limiting the lawyer's liability to a client for malpractice. That's what's barred by 1.8H. It is our position that he did make an agreement and that the term, the lawyer's liability, should be read by this Court in the broadest sense, including the law firm when it says the lawyer's liability. And that's the argument in terms of the count, of that other count as well. Because if you say it's only the individual lawyer, if you take a narrow reading of 1.8H, then it can lead to a very silly result where an attorney could say, okay, I work for Jones and Smith, I'm giving my client a release for Jones and Smith, but not for me personally. Well, I didn't violate 1.8H because I only released the firm. Well, if Jones and Smith is a limited liability corporation, you've accomplished exactly what you aimed to without violating 1.8H. That can't be what it means because it's a ridiculous result. So what we're saying is that you have to give a broad reading to the term the lawyer's liability, including the lawyer's liability being not just the lawyer as an individual and as a person, but also as the law firm.
Counsel, I know that we have counts 7 and 12 yet to deal with, but I want to jump ahead to sanctions.
Okay.
Mr. Reitz prevails, and this case involves 13 counts and 6 different clients. So we've got, that's of concern to me, 6 different clients. But let's say he prevails on the now 3 contested counts. What's your recommendation with regard to the sanction and why?
The most egregious of the counts are 2 of those that are before the Court. The one we've just talked about in terms of Ms. Crosby and the Krauss count because of the misrepresentation. Absent the misrepresentation count, I would agree with Mr. Reitz that a suspension of 2 to 4 months would be appropriate discipline. It's a little difficult, as the Chief Justice noted in questioning earlier, is we do a lot of comparisons with cases. We have some in our brief. Mr. Reitz has some in his brief. And trying to compare these cases and make them fit in sometimes is trying to fit a round pegs into square holes in a lot of instances. But the most important factor is the severity of the violations. And I don't mean to diminish lack of diligence and lack of communication with clients. Those are very serious. But on a relative scale, the most serious violation would be the misrepresentation in the Krauss one, number one, and number two in the Crosby one in terms of taking advantage of the client. If the Court does find that those are violations, then OLR's position is a 6-month suspension is appropriate. Absent those two, I would agree with Mr. Reitz.
One follow-up question, if I may. This is an inexact science in terms of sanctions, and we use other cases to give us guidelines. Usually there's not much difference between 4 months and 5 months. You know, tell me how I can really make a difference between 4 months and 5 months and give a principled distinction. And what about 5 months and 5.5 months? You know, there's no principal distinction. And maybe even no principal distinction between 5.5 and 6 months. But there sure is a difference in consequence. And the difference in consequence is once you hit the 6-month suspension, then you have to go for a whole new procedure in terms of being reinstated. And oftentimes, my experience, that reinstatement takes many, many, many months. So that once you hit a 6-month suspension, in effect, it is not unusual for someone not to get their license back for a year plus. Should I take that into consideration? Why, and I'm not saying this is at all right, but I want you to get rid of my thought process. Why shouldn't I say, well, look, there's an argument for 4 months. We had a recent case of Orlai versus Goldstein where, again, there was 12 counts. It was 6 different clients. A lot of it dealt with lack of diligence and failure to keep informed. We gave 4 months on that one. So why don't I just give, since it's really 4 months to 6 months, why don't I give, 5 months or 5.5 months, but something less than 6 to avoid reinstatement, because 6 really means at least a year. Tell me what's wrong with my thought process. If 4 months away from practice is going to protect the public, 5 months is going to go, but 6 months steps it up to a year. Do you need him out for a year?
The best they can do is to tell the justice that to the extent to which you're thinking may be faulty, well, I'm guilty as well, because I have the same issue, the same thought process that goes into these cases. I've handled maybe 30 or 40 of these cases over the past 20 years, and there's a leap where you get to that, I was going to say 5 months and 29 days, that is very significant. And at what point or what process do you say an individual case goes over that amount? I'm very familiar with the Goldstein case, as the court may know, and the facts in that case do differ from this one in one significant effect, which is the misrepresentation aspect of it. That tends to be the factor, and I've read many of these cases, I try to read all of them that come down and study them very carefully, and to try to find the thinking of this court, and to the extent to make sense of it, to which that becomes an important factor in that 6-month period. And all I can do is reassure the court that before this recommendation is made, a great deal of hard work and thinking go into this. In this case in particular, I spoke with Keith Saline, who directs my work in this case, to go over the facts, to compare it with various cases, including the Goldstein case, in terms of whether or not the conduct in this case reached that magic amount. So I don't know if there's any solace to this court, but OLR does take this very seriously, thinks about it in exactly the way Justice Bradley went through her thought process, and tries to consider where's that point where the public needs additional protection. The leap tends to be less in the amount of time for a suspension. Certainly for Mr. Reitz, it's very important if it's 4 or 5 months, it's 1 month sooner that he can get back into the practice if that's his wish. The major factor is that the additional 6 months is incurred by a hearing process and a reinstatement process that's very rigorous. I represented OLR in one about 2 years ago, and it is amazing the amount of work and effort that OLR puts into investigating what the client's conduct was in that interim period, what the lawyer did. Did the lawyer practice law during that period of time? Did the lawyer show remorse? Is the lawyer giving any guarantees that upon reinstatement, these problems will not recur and he won't or she would have to be back in front of this court? That tends to be the guideline in terms of, is that additional step necessary? And if it is, the extra time it takes for reinstatement is well spent time. If it's not, it isn't. And the guideline tends to be, in the cases that I've read, the severity of the nature of the cases. If this was merely a matter of lack of diligence and lack of communication, I think it could be reasonably said that Mr. Reitz gets a timeout for 2 to 4 months, gets away from the practice, cleans up, his act, essentially. By that time, he can start all over again and hopefully would have learned his lessons from it. The guideline here comes if there is a deceit and a dishonesty that was involved, if there was misleading, if there were clients that were badly compromised, along with the other factors, but those tend to be the most severe, in which OLR says, I think before this lawyer is reinstated, we want to have a process set up where that attorney can show that he or she has done what is appropriate in the meantime, has not practiced law in the meantime, and has done whatever acts are necessary to prove that getting his or her license back would be a permanent reinstatement.
So it is this count with Crosby, or is it Krause rather, the misrepresentation that is the linchpin for you here?
I think so. The Crosby one is important, too, because it was taking advantage of a client. The client shows up for the deposition. He gives you this document, and that is a very important one. The fact, as you mentioned, Justice, the fact that there are six different cases here, I'm more impressed with that than by the 13 counts, because many of these counts are fairly closely related. So it's less the number of counts than the number of clients, which shows a pattern of behavior. And what pushes this over from that from that 5 month, 29 days to the 6 months, really is the Crosby count in terms of the misrepresentation in there.
You mean the Krause count? Krause involved the misrepresentation where they sent the summons and complaint with a letter. It was a course of time from 1999 to 2001. I think this was count 6 and 7, but I just wanted your discussion because that's the one that Mr. Reitz talked about as far as he thought that the OLR had gone overboard as far as their recommendation. I'd like to know your thought on the misrepresentation and the continuing course of conduct over those 3 years between the client, Krause, and the law firm.
First, Your Honor, if I may, the rule itself does not prohibit just, it doesn't say you can't lie. What it says is, and I'm referring to 8.4 sub C, it's engage in conduct involving dishonesty. And the conduct is what we're concerned with here that Mr. Reitz engaged in. And there are a number of different aspects which the referee, who is the finder of fact in this case, found was a conduct involving dishonesty. The first, as was always pointed out, is the complaint that was sent to her was a signed complaint. And to a layperson, seeing a complaint that is signed is an indication that something actually happened with the complaint. If you sent her a draft complaint that was unsigned, perhaps then Mr. Reitz's argument of apples and oranges might be well taken, that she may have misunderstood it. But expecting her to know that a filed complaint has a filed stamp on it may be beyond what attorneys normally would, or non-attorneys would normally understand. Second, there was a cover letter with the complaint that said, please find enclosed a copy of the summons and complaint for your lawsuit. So it didn't say, enclosed, please find a draft. It didn't say, as my office would if we sent a draft, a big red stamp on it saying draft. Instead, the letter expressly said, please find enclosed a copy of the summons and complaint. Having a cover letter like that, a document called a summons and complaint that was signed, would easily lead someone to believe that this lawsuit had been actually filed with the court. Then the real linchpin of this to show that this was conduct involving misrepresentation, and I refer you, and the referee has it in her findings, to Ms. Krause's testimony, which is that she waits, she gets the summons and complaint, and she understood that a response is required within 45 days. She waits 45 days and hears nothing, and then she testifies, and this was found credible by the referee, that she calls Mr. Reitz and asks what's going on, and Mr. Reitz says, and I quote from Ms. Krause's testimony, he told me that the other side had denied the claim, which was to be expected, and he would set a date with the judge to schedule a conference to hopefully resolve it before the next needed court date. He said he would write and call in 10 days. So in addition to sending the signed complaint with that cover letter, he talks to her about having a court date coming up, and then later he calls, she calls him back, she says on June 5th, and if, in the testimony, Ms. Krause kept very good records of all these conversations. Question, did you talk to him on that date? Answer, yes. Question, and tell us about that conversation. Answer, he said he talked to the court clerk who will call him back within a few days. I told him to then call me with the date that the court clerk gave him. Well, as it doesn't, even a layperson understands that when you're talking to a court clerk and getting a date coming up, that there's been a complaint that's filed. So referring again back to 1.4, the violation is the course of conduct involving dishonesty. In reading it all together, it's clear that it was designed to lead her to believe that the complaint had been filed. And getting back finally to close the loop to Justice Bradley's questions, because of the severity of the nature of this is why OLR felt that it crosses that imaginary line into needing more severe discipline.
I ask you on 28.4C, engage in conduct involving dishonesty, fraud, deceit, or misrepresentation. Is there mens rea of some sort required here?
No, and I don't believe there is, Your Honor, because it doesn't say intend to engage in conduct. It just says engaging in that conduct. And I'm not sure if you could concoct a situation where someone didn't have the necessary mens rea but still engaged in that conduct. I suppose if you speculated enough, you might be able to come up with that. But in this case, given the whole context of the lawsuit, the fact that she was concerned that nothing was happening, the fact that she was calling to see what was going on with the lawsuit, reading it all in together, I think in this case, even if that was a requirement, it'd be easy enough to find the necessary mens rea. But I don't believe it is an element. It's the conduct itself that's prohibited, not the mindset of the attorney.
So any time an attorney misrepresents a fact unknowingly, that's a violation of this rule?
Well, says, Your Honor, with all respect, it says engaging in conduct involving dishonesty. So if I mistakenly state something to the court, that's not conduct engaging in dishonesty. That's an error.
Why?
Why isn't that conduct?
It is conduct, but it's not conduct involving dishonesty. It's conduct involving an error, which is not prohibited by the rule.
What's the difference between error and dishonesty if you don't have mens rea? In other words,
there may be cases in which there would be one. I don't think this is one, Your Honor.
Well, in this case,
in fact, I'm going to step further. I think by definition, if you're dishonest, you are showing mens rea. I may be trying to split hairs here too much, and if I do, I apologize.
It is mens rea.
I can't think of a situation offhand where you're being dishonest and not showing a mens rea for dishonesty and deceit.
Well, here, as I understand Mr. Reitz's position, I'm going to put it outside of him. I'm practicing law, and I send a summons and complaint thinking I'm going to file this right away. And then I think more about it, and I think, no, I'm not going to get into the court scene. I'm going to try and mediate this, and if I file, I've taken it up a notch. Different people might be involved, whereas if I stay at non-court, I might be able to mediate it. So I don't file it. I mediate. I tell the lawyer, mediate. And here, she may be, in retrospect, she thinks it's filed, but she thinks now that she looks back at it, he was trying to tell her mediation. Okay, that sort of fails, so now I send a second summons and complaint. Do I ever file that?
Was the second summons and complaint filed here? Okay. It was filed here. She's angry, the client's angry, because it's taken so long, and I'm right where I would have been had I listened to her in the first place. Is that dishonesty? Assuming at all times I'm not trying to mislead her, at all times I'm not trying to pacify her into thinking I'm doing something when I'm not, but I've just changed my mind. You change your mind a lot in practicing a law. You go along one track and you think, uh-uh, and you double back, right?
I just did about 30 seconds ago.
Okay. So this happens. Happens to all of us. Happens as a judge when I write opinions. Happens when I listen to the cases. So you change your mind and you reverse track. Is that dishonesty under this?
No, that would not be, but that's not what happened in this count, however. And if it had been a matter where, and there's a difference also in the rules between inappropriate professional behavior, something just isn't smart to do, a good practice, and something that violates our rules of ethics. It is not good practice to send a complaint that's not filed to a client without making it very, very clear to the client that that complaint is not being filed. That's why there are red stamps. That's why there's a cover letter saying that. If all Mr. Reitz had done was to mail a signed complaint to her without any cover letter at all, say, and put it in the mail, then it would be questionable whether that is exhibiting the correct mens rea and whether that would be engaging in conduct involving dishonesty. If you isolate that one part of his conduct, that wasn't the only part of his misconduct. You have to consider it in the entire context, and that's why I get back to 8.4 saying it's conduct involving, not the individual act. So the conduct is not just sign a complaint and send it to her without stamping draft, which I think is poorly professional behavior. What moves it to unethical or misrepresentation is the cover letter saying enclosed, please find, not specifying it's a draft. And most importantly is the subsequent conversations where she calls him and says what's going on, and he talks about court dates. And
counsel, there never was, and maybe I misunderstood your answer, there never was a summons and complaint filed in this matter, right?
I don't recall. I thought that there was a second one compiled.
In the finding, that's why I was reading. It says Reitz failed to file the new summons and complaint. So there never, I understood there never was one.
But then the second one wasn't filed either, Your Honor. I stand corrected. Once again, stand corrected. Thank you, Your Honor.
Well, I just wanted to.
And that supports your argument. Okay.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Herman. Mr. Reitz, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. The second summons and complaint was not filed. That is clear. I don't want to split hairs, but with respect to the Nari Crosby release, my understanding was that service corporations and LLCs do not provide any insulation for professional liability for the attorneys. I could be mistaken, but I didn't think that that was the case, that you could do that merely by incorporating. Otherwise, I basically just wanted to thank the court for letting me address you orally.
Before you thank us, I would like a response, if you will, with regard to the allegation of misrepresentation and deceit. Your opposing counsel indicates that it isn't just the letter sending the summons and complaint and the sending of the signed summons and complaint, but he says most importantly it's the follow-up conversations. And he told us of those follow-up conversations regarding allegedly that your client wanted them to be sued, and statements like, well, I'll talk with the judge or get a date from the court clerk. How do you respond to that, which he apparently thinks is the most important?
With respect to a court clerk, I don't have a response to that. I don't recall that conversation. I know that Ms. Cross did testify that I had used that language. Judge, I would have used that language because typically we use retired judge as far as a mediation is concerned. And so I absolutely recall conversations with that. And I think that by the use we want to get this in front of a judge, we want a hearing with the judge, we're talking about a mediation. At least my testimony on this matter was relative to a mediation. And Ms. Causey later on indicated, gosh, maybe that was in retrospect. Even if you accept everything that she had said as true, certainly by July, she was aware that the lawsuit had not been filed. Because her testimony was, I still wanted this lawsuit to get going. So that certainly sometime within that period of those 4 months, if you accept everything that she says is true literally and ignore the fact that she was later on saying, I might have been mistaken here, if there was a misrepresentation, it was remedied fairly quickly.
But on the lawsuit, just to follow up, it said by September 23rd, it was apparent that American Country did not wish to increase its offer or mediate, so that on that date, a new but substantially identical summons and complaint was prepared for filing, and that one was not filed either. And then she went to a new lawyer.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Any other questions?
No other questions. Thank you, Mr. Wright, for appearing and helping us understand this case. And thank you, Mr. Herman, for your excellent representation of the position of OLR. And we appreciate your consulting with OLR relating to potential sanctions depending on the court's view of this case. So with that, we close the hearing on 03-2518D OLR versus rights. The court is in recess, and we will meet again at 1:30 in closed conference. Thank you.